This week on Making Contact.
I wouldn't be here today if there wasn't a moratorium at that time. They gave me the maximum amount of time allowed by law. If the death penalty would have been in effect, I would be dead in 76 because that's when my appeal was turned down.
The recent California state executions of Stanley Tookie Williams and Clarence Ray Allen reignited the debate over the death penalty. The state taking a life, is it justice for the victim or revenge for a crime committed? On this edition, we'll hear from both sides of the argument and about what two California assembly members are doing to halt future executions. I'm Tina Rubio, your host this week on Making Contact, a program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. ...3,383 people are on death row in the U.S. as of October 2005. And according to the Death Penalty Information Center, about 46% are Caucasian, 42% African American, and a little more than 10% Latino. More than half the countries worldwide have abolished the death penalty in law or in practice. Yet the U.S. and Iran are the most prolific executioners in the world. That's according to Amnesty International. Some death penalty advocates argue it's a punishment that fits the crime. But there's a large number of people whose family members were murdered who don't support the death penalty. Bill Pelkey is one of them. He's an unlikely anti-death penalty activist. When the former steelworker from Indiana, who went to Bible school and served in the U.S. military, found out his grandmother had been brutally beaten and murdered in her own home, he wanted the killer to get the death penalty. And that's exactly what happened. The convicted murderer, 15-year-old Paula Cooper, a girl who said she only wanted money to play arcade games. Paula became the youngest girl in the United States to receive a death sentence. Bill describes in detail what happened to his grandmother, and I'll warn you, the details are graphic.
It was terrible. I mean, it was very painful. My grandmother was brought on course that she was stabbed 33 times with a 12-inch butcher knife. In fact, they had a section of the carpet that was on her body, was in the courtroom that day, and showed how that carpet had been shredded by the knife. They also had pictures of the hardwood floor that was underneath her body, and showed how that hardwood floor had been splintered and bruised by the knife. And so whenever I thought about my grandmother during that period of a year and a half, I pictured her butchered on the dining room floor. And this was a dining room where our family gathered every year for Christmas Eve, Thanksgiving, Easter, birthdays, happy, joyous occasions.
Bill says before the death of his grandmother, he was pretty conservative in his views.
You don't even have no idea how conservative my background was because while I was working at Bethlehem Steel on the GI Bill, I went to a Bible college, which was a very conservative Baptist Bible college. And in fact, when I graduated from college, Jerry Falwell delivered our commencement. And I guess I became a liberal overnight.
What happened next took Bill Pelkey down a road he never imagined for himself.
I was at work at Bethlehem Steel, and as I sat up in my crane, I began to reflect on my grandmother's life and on my grandmother's death, and actually kind of began looking upward and just kind of saying, why, why did our family have to go through all that, just asking why. I just became convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that my grandmother would have been appalled by the fact that this girl was on death row. The girl's grandfather had been in the courtroom that day, and as the judge had begun to deliver the sentence, he began to cry and to wail very loudly how they were going to kill his baby, how they were going to kill his baby. And I knew that my grandmother would not want this old man to have to go through what a grandfather would have to go through to see a granddaughter he loves strapped into the electric chair and the volts of electricity put to her.
Bill was able to help overturn Paula's death sentence. Today, she remains in jail, serving a 60-year sentence. As for Bill, he is now the chairman of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And in 1993, he founded Journey of Hope, a nonprofit made up of a group of families of murder victims who travel to cities across the U.S., sharing their personal stories and their desire to get rid of the death penalty. A movie called Step by Step was just made about the group.
We travel now to over 10 countries and probably about 40 states, just sharing our message and talking about how the death penalty, a lot of people want the death penalty. It's just purely a matter of revenge. And revenge is never, ever the answer. It's never the answer. And the answer is compassion for all humanity. And you cannot have compassion for all humanity and want to see somebody put into the death chamber and their life taken from them. It's impossible.
He says sharing their own personal stories has a tremendous impact on others.
Because all of us on the Journey of Hope, we speak from our hearts. And when you speak from your heart, you're going to touch other people's hearts. And if you touch other people's hearts, then you can get them to rethink some of their positions on ideas.
8 years after the death of Bill's grandmother, he met Paula Cooper for the first time.
The three-hour drive home from the visit with her, the word wonderful, wonderful, wonderful just kept crossing my mind. Wonderful that I was able to meet with somebody that had done such a terrible thing to my grandmother, had done such a terrible thing to our family, and yet not have the hate and anger towards her that would be so easily to have. It was something that if she could take it back, she'd take it back in a minute. She knows that she can't take it back, that it's something she has to live with for the rest of her life. But she's not the same person today that she was back in 1985. It was well documented. She was raised very abusively by her father. And she learned one thing well by the age of 15, and that was how to hate. After the fact of the murder, there were a number of people, five or six people, that did show her love and compassion, and she has responded to that. And today, she's just a very caring person. Her goal in life is to get as much education as she can to help develop spiritually as much as she can. Her goal is to help other young people that were also raised in abusive situations and try to help them by saying, I responded with violence and that was wrong, and look where it got me.
Although Bill does not support the death penalty, he isn't soft on crime.
I'm an advocate. I mean, if a person has committed multiple brutal, heinous crimes, I think that person has given up his right to walk down the streets of a free society, and that person should be kept in prison for the rest of his natural life. Let him walk into his jail cell and come out in his jail cell when we've got to carry him out where he's died a natural death, but not because we have killed that person. When a state kills, they kill in your name. They kill in my name. And, I don't want anybody unnecessarily killed in my name. When I was in Vietnam, I was in the infantry. We fought a war. We tried to kill the enemy. But when we captured the enemy, and once we had that enemy and he became a prisoner of war, we no longer tried to kill him. When John Wayne Gacy, who committed terrible, terrible crimes, responsible for the death of, I believe, 33 young men, society was safe when John Wayne Gacy was arrested and put in jail. They weren't any safer the day after he was executed.
For now, Bill says he'll continue to work to abolish capital punishment, adding, the U.S. is moving in that direction, but there is still a ways to go.
I've stood by the sides of many mothers on the nights that their sons were executed, and their mothers love their sons as much as my mother loves me. And to stand by their side and just wait while the state kills their sons, I mean, it's really cruel and barbaric. You would think in a civilized society we could find a better way to deal with this. And the people that get sentenced to death, many of them have mental problems, and we go after the easy ones when we go for the death penalty. I could never condone what Paula Cooper did, but with compassion, I can understand why maybe she did what she did, and that we need to work with different social things to try to prevent more Paula Coopers from doing what she did.
We'll have more in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. The average time spent on death row varies from state to state. Because of the appeals process, the average time served in California is 17 years. Citizens United for Alternatives to the Death Penalty says, as a result, it can cost six times as much to kill one person as it costs to incarcerate that person for life. The ethnicity of the defendant and victim is not supposed to influence whether a person is sentenced to death, but many argue it does. The U.S. General Accounting Office found people convicted of murdering Caucasians were more likely to be sentenced to death than those convicted of murdering African Americans. California has the nation's largest death row, with 648 people condemned to death, 15 of those women. Recent DNA tests have exonerated more than 120 people on death row in the U.S., six in California. And now two California Assembly members introduced a proposal for a two-year moratorium on the death penalty. Making contact, Sarah Olson has more.
Stanley Williams spent his last day visiting with his legal team and friends. He was executed by lethal injection shortly after midnight. He was pronounced dead at 0035 military time.
I just got the word that they have just announced Stan's execution. It's all over.
We say hell no!
They say death row!
We say hell no!
They say death row!
When California executed Stanley Tookie Williams on December 13, 2005, it ignited worldwide protest against the death penalty. Williams was the co-founder of the notorious Crips gang in Los Angeles, California. But while on death row for a 1981 quadruple murder conviction, Williams became an anti-gang violence advocate. He wrote a series of children's books discouraging kids from the gang life and offered a sense of hope to those in need.
I'd like to read a piece from Brother Tookie's book, Gangs and the Abuse of Power, Mobbing. We learned that if we walked around the hood in big crowds, we could usually get anything we wanted.
Williams captured the public's imagination. His case pitted the notion of redemption against one idea of justice. On the one side, victims' rights organizations said Williams was unrepentant, never even admitting to the murders. On the other side, anti-death penalty advocates demanded to know how the state could execute a Nobel Peace Prize nominee who spent his life behind bars educating and mentoring at-risk youth.
We didn't stop to think about right or wrong. That's why we got into so much trouble. There's a strength in numbers, but that strength must be used for the right reasons.
Williams' execution occurred at a time when California lawmakers are considering legislation to halt executions until at least 2008. The legislation, AB 1121, is authored by California Assembly members Paul Koretz and Sally Leiber. It has an impressive list of supporters as well, including former prosecutor Donald Heller, who wrote California's current death penalty laws. One question the legislation addresses: what is gained by an execution? That question inspired rapper Snoop Dogg to speak on Williams' behalf. He argued Williams' work with children saved the lives of young people no one else seemed to care about.
Anytime you got a voice that's saving lives and trying to, you know, put people in a different position where they don't have to shoot, kill, rob, murder, where they can talk about their problems and converse and try to understand that we're just a conversation away from peace, you got to keep that alive.
At the heart of the proposed California moratorium is the question of innocence. In the past 15 years, more than 200 people have been wrongly convicted of serious felonies in California. That's according to the American Civil Liberties Union. And according to the Death Penalty Information Center, more than 120 death row inmates have been exonerated.
My name is Aaron Owens. In 1972, I was convicted of a double murder. Well, it was a capital offense, came under horrendous crime. Later, in 1983, I was exonerated of that case.
It was a worst-case scenario. Despite a solid alibi and circumstantial evidence, Owen spent years of his life behind bars. The first 3 years were in solitary confinement at Folsom State Prison. Owen says the murders he was convicted of were so vicious that the prison guards knew his name even before he arrived.
The killing was one that was really, really horrendous. They were both shot in the chest with 38s, and their heads were blown off, supposedly with a sawed-off shotgun.
At the time of Owen's conviction, the death penalty was not in place in California, something for which he is profoundly grateful.
I wouldn't be here today if there wasn't a moratorium at that time. They gave me the maximum amount of time allowed by law. If the death penalty would have been in effect, I would be dead in 76 because that's when my appeal was turned down.
Despite the odds, Owen says he never gave up hope. At his parole hearing, Owen's prosecuting attorney heard his case and reopened the investigation. After 11 years in prison, Owens left a free man.
Name one of the victims' names.
Your name. Would you like to say?
Name,
your
name one.
Your name.
Jesse Jackson
your
is
name.
Here. He's claiming that he knows why he should not be put to death. He
your
should
name.
Know at least
your
one
name.
Name of the victims.
Your name.
We know. Name. We know name. All of them.
And while a cadre of anti-death penalty activists are concerned about the innocence of people like Aaron Owens, others are concerned about the victims of violent crime. Harriet Salerno's daughter Katina was murdered in 1979. Katina had recently started her freshman year at the University of Pacific. A high school friend stalked her, and a week later she was dead, shot execution style. Salerno has made preventing similar tragedies her life's work.
You need to think of the people on the street. We lost our loved ones. They're gone. But we're thinking of people like you. That is safe in your to walk on the streets, safe to attend school, safe to shop, safe in your home. And that should be a priority, not to protect them.
Salerno says her own life was ripped apart by the man who murdered her daughter, a fate she says she wouldn't wish on anyone. She believes anti-death penalty activists are turning the justice system upside down. Into a system she says is designed to support the criminals, not the victims of crime or their families.
Have you ever stopped and think how many murderers got away with murder? Have you ever stopped to think how you have destroyed the victims' families?
Salerno says talking about a death penalty moratorium or rehabilitation is a waste of time.
You have to identify who could be rehabilitated. Can the people on death row be rehabilitated? No, they can't. Because under the circumstances they were sent to death row, these are very evil, sick people.
It often comes down to trust in the system. To believe that each person on death row has been fairly tried, justly convicted, and is incapable of rehabilitation requires a deep belief in the infallibility of the U.S. judicial system.
They can hear us in San Quentin.
This is not a belief harbored by Stephanie Fouché. She's the program director at Death Penalty Focus and a staunch advocate of moratorium legislation. She says many family members of murder victims have joined her efforts, in part out of fear that the wrong people have been convicted of murder.
I feel like it's very dishonest to say that an attempt to make the system more fair and more just and make sure that the right people are behind bars is offensive to victims, because everyone wants the right people behind bars. Nobody wants innocent people in jail and true killers out on the street.
But many argue you don't have to be falsely convicted of murder to oppose the death penalty.
Do we want the death penalty in Alabama?
No!
Do we want the death penalty in Georgia?
No!
Do we want the death penalty in Texas?
No!
Do we want the death penalty in California?
No!
Do we want the death penalty in California?
No!
In California, a growing number of people oppose capital punishment. And an even larger number supports putting a moratorium in place until the state can determine whether the death penalty is fairly applied. Natasha Minsker is the director of death penalty policy at the ACLU of Northern California. She says the death penalty is disproportionately levied against poor people and people of color. Minsker says it all comes down to money or to the luck of the draw.
It's really the lucky few who are given a quality advocate, either because of their own resources or because the court happens to give them a good lawyer, who have access to justice. And if you don't have money available to you, and if you don't have a good lawyer fighting for you, then you are on your own.
The death penalty moratorium is currently stalled in the California Assembly Appropriations Committee. It's unlikely to be passed in its current form. However, its authors and supporters are expected to introduce revised legislation later this year. This means the next California execution is scheduled for February 21st at San Quentin State Prison. For Making Contact, I'm Sarah Olson.
The death penalty is a highly sensitive issue for many. Those that are staunch supporters of capital punishment were angry over California's proposed moratorium on executions. They say the attention given to the people on death row is disproportionate to the attention given to the victims of the crime. Maggie Elvey is the executive assistant at Crime Victims United of California. Her husband was murdered in 1993 by a Los Angeles Crips gang member. CVUC aims to enhance public safety, promote effective crime reduction measures, and strengthen the rights of crime victims through education and political action. Making Contact's Emily Polk spoke to Maggie about why she supports the death penalty.
You know, years ago, you just understood that if you took a life, you would give up your life. And nowadays, it's becoming where, I don't know, maybe we have so many bleeding heart liberals that think it's okay to murder somebody and eventually walk back out in the street. You know, and it just doesn't make any sense because our loved ones can't get back up and walk around. They're gone. You know, maybe if we got back to carrying it out a little faster here in California, then they'd realize that, yes, it is a deterrent, and there is punishment when you make a choice to commit murder.
Did you always feel this way?
Yes. My husband and I both were in favor of the death penalty. With life without possibility of parole, there is no guarantee that that person will be in there for life. And also, they can still continue to kill from inside the prisons. We've seen that with just the last Clarence Allen that was executed. He had been in prison for killing a person, and he managed to have three other people murdered while he was still in prison. And in my case, one of the juveniles who happened to be 16 that murdered my husband received a life without possibility of parole. And now, in reading some of the media news, I find out that there's a senator, there's 180 juveniles in California that under 18 receive life without possibility of parole sentences. And now the senator here in California wants to reduce their sentences so that they can have parole hearings. And that just is not fair to the victims. These are the kids that had committed the worst of the worst crimes.
Does it matter at all, like the conditions, the social or political conditions that lead to these people committing these crimes, or is that just not any issue that's addressed?
There's a lot of people out there in this world that have had a lot of problems, and they don't resort to murder. And so it's just that, you know what, we grow up learning that, you know, you treat the person next to you like you want to be treated. This race bit, actually, there is more white people on death row in California than there are blacks. So, you know, that's not always a good excuse. I mean, why did we have such a big turnout for anti-Tookie death penalty, but for Clarence Allen, there was hardly any?
Why do you think?
I think it was a race game, and it's just really sad because Tookie has been responsible for a lot more than just four deaths. I mean, there's Crips gang members that are killing every day. The two juveniles that murdered my husband were in a Crips gang. My husband was murdered in 93 by a 15 and a 16-year-old. They beat him over the head with a metal pipe, and he was in a coma for 41 days before he passed away, and they were so-called gang members of 187 Crips. And one street name was Nine because he could get 9mm handguns for people, and the other one, the 16-year-old, was 187 Insane. And, of course, we know that's the police code for murder, the 187. So the detectives thought it was probably his initiation since they held my husband down and beat him over the head. He had 25 skull fractures and one the size of a 50-cent piece that they couldn't even put back together. The really sad part is these people are forgetting that there's consequences for choices that they make. And when they make bad choices, maybe there's bad punishment that comes along with it, you know?
What happened to the people who murdered your husband?
One could not be tried as an adult, so he was in the California Youth Authority and out in a matter of 9 years. and the other one serving a life sentence without possibility of parole.
You know, there's a lot of groups out there who, including Families of Murder Victims for Reconciliation, these groups who have all had family members who've been murdered, and they are very active in speaking out against the death penalty and against... Right. And how does your organization, or how do you work with those people who are also victims of horrendous tragedies?
Well, you know, that's why we don't speak for everybody that's in our organization, but everybody should have the right to speak up for what they believe in. It's okay for those that are anti the death penalty to speak up, but for the people that are for it, it's like, oh, we shouldn't be saying anything. But we have to learn to speak up for what we feel is right.
Where does forgiveness come in, and does it come in at all?
Into when you're I call it a homicide victim survivor. That is up to each individual. Some can forgive and some can't. You know, many times people will say to a victim, well, you need to forgive these people and go on with your life. Well, maybe we think we are, you know, and there is nothing that tells us anywhere that we have to forgive. You know, they've never, in my case, the kids have never asked to be forgiven. And I, you know, for what they took away from me and my family and our friends, I mean, there's only so much that you can forgive. You can always go on with your life, but it's never the same. There is never closure. People say, well, now that he's been put to death, maybe the family can have closure. Well, you know what? There's always those birthdays, those anniversaries, those holidays, special moments and memories that'll come back forever until the day we're buried. And so to say there's closure is completely wrong. And to say somebody has to forgive somebody is completely wrong. I mean, we all do things and grieve in our own way. That's everybody's right. It seems like every day there's a new battle that victims have to fight, and it just gets to you after a while. You know, like I think, well, the 16-year-old back then, now he's spending his life in prison, but then all of a sudden I open a page to a newspaper and find out that some senator's going to come along and try to give those kids so they can have parole hearings. Well, that's not fair to the victim. I mean, they've had that person sentenced. They've been through court. They've been through, you know, trials. They've had, you know, judges or juries sentence these people. And
is the answer to killing, killing?
Well, you know, it's only given to a few that, you know, in California here, it has to be a first-degree murder with special circumstances. So like I say, normally they're very heinous crimes that these people have done that receive the death penalty. Some victims probably don't like that, and, you know, I was okay with life without possibility of parole for this one kid, but then more I keep thinking about it, you know, he could possibly get out. And for them standing there over my husband, holding him down, beating him, so that he has 25 skull fractures, one the size of a 50-cent piece that can't be repaired, to me that's cruel and unusual punishment for not doing anything. So, see, they didn't even offer him his life. They just took it.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, and Steve Macer. For a CD copy of program number 0606, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, outreach coordinator, Tom Evans, development associate, and Emily Polk, production fellow. I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.